folks. You are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show here on thelandofisrael.com, broadcasting live from Jerusalem to the world. And you're a part of it wherever you are. Welcome to the show. I am at beautiful Beit Midrash Sulamia Akov in the heart of Jerusalem in the Nachlaot neighborhood. And you know what that means? It means it's time for Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Yishai. It's great to be here.
Well, you know that it says that a sign that the redemption is indeed here is when the land of Israel turns green. So for some of us, one of the greatest signs of redemption is when we have allergies, right? So I'm feeling pretty allergic today, and therefore Geula, the rebirth of the Jewish people in the land of Israel, must be happening since the land is incredibly green. And not only is it green, but it's also flush with cash because the other kind of green. Why do I say that? Because as I was driving over here, I was talking on the phone with my colleague Pinchas, my friend, who said to me that Rav Kanievsky said that Mashiach is at the doorway already. And I said to him, I'm no Rav Kanievsky, but as I'm stopped here at this red light, I'm looking to the left and I see a huge building going up here in Jerusalem. So I'm no Rav Kanievsky. But I know, too, that we're in the Messianic times. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, there's a saying that they attribute to Rav Shalom Gold. You know Rav Gold?
Sure.
That if you want to talk to God, you should go to the Beit Knesset. But if you want to see God, go to the Shuk. You know, go to the market here and just see the abundance that the land is giving out. Because what you're referring to is that the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Ein ket migule mizeh. There is no greater sign, actually, of redemption than the fact that the land of Israel gives forth its produce. And I'm always astounded about the fact that we export fruit all over the world. I mean, this whole BDS movement that's going on now, which on one hand I think is truly evil, on the other hand I kind of laugh at. Nevertheless, it wouldn't have gotten off the ground if it weren't for the fact that we are everywhere as such a small people, that the abundance which is available to us is pouring out. It's pouring out.
I think the depth of BDS is not only to try to destroy Israel, but it's to try to stop the world from enjoying the blessings that Israel has to offer. Meaning to say, if I'm BDSing in Ireland, then I'm going to stop the Irish from receiving the blessings of Israel, and therefore they'll be able to keep hating Israel, because once you taste from the manna that the land of Israel is exporting out to the world, there's a sweetness to it that it's addictive. So they want to keep that taste away from people.
I think that there's always also, oddly enough, a real attempt to kill hope. You know, because our story, with all the difficulties, and you and I have hashed it out before, and it's not simple, et cetera, but with all the difficulties, it's a story of hope. I mean, could you imagine? I mean, we think about the abundance here. I'm sure you've seen the pictures of what this area looked like 100 years ago.
Desolate. And how many descriptions do we have of people like Mark Twain? Desolate is the recurring theme in the writings when they visited 150 years ago.
One of the agricultural backbones of Israel is the area of Kiryat Gat, you know, down in sort of south-central Israel.
That's where the wheat is grown.
Exactly. Do you know that Kiryat Gat used to be the northern edge of the Negev?
Right.
It was the northern edge of the desert. And today, nobody associates it with Beersheba. That's the northern edge of the Negev. Beersheba was the middle of the Negev then, right? And so the hopefulness, which is so connected to the joy of the season that we're in, is the fact that the world offers more than you see. And the present does not define the future, right? That's that revolutionary energy of Purim, which begins to rise in Adar, is that, okay, you're looking at the world, you think you know what you're seeing. And the world has all kinds of judgments on us as a people, and this whole BDS nonsense, right? But we're basically telling them, listen, don't judge by what you see. Open yourself to hope and the joy of what is not yet.
The hashtag that you're referring to, I think, is BDSBS. That is the lies that are being perpetrated, and you're absolutely right. The opposite is hope. Now, some people get a little hopeless when they enter this week's Torah portion, Tetzaveh. And that is because it's yet again one of these blueprint Torah portions which have no real narrative-driving story. There's no story here. There's really a lot of
detail.
And now, if we talked about the vessels in Parshat Truma in last week's Torah portion, vessels, this week it's vestments. Vestments, but at the end of the Torah portion, there will be one more vessel. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. And this is a fascinating Torah portion. And I must tell you, Rabbi Mike, that as my personal relationship to Torah has grown, I knew when I was younger that these Torah portions were hard for me, and I couldn't really get into them. Now, as I'm getting a little bit older, I'm finding more excitement and interest in them, in these details Torah portions, and I'm kind of coming back. My mind has kind of it's more interested now in the images and ideas of these Torah portions. So I'm excited to talk about the Tzaveh with you, as opposed to maybe a few years ago where I would have been like, how can we get around this thing? So the vestments of the priests, of the high priest especially, are described in this week's Torah portion in incredible fine detail, resolution. And the glaring first thing that one learns about the Torah portion of Tetzaveh is that something is missing. And that something is somebody, and that's Moshe Rabbeinu. Mm. The name of Moses is erased or not found in the Torah portion, while Aaron and his sons are described over and over and over again. Aaron will wear this, Aaron will wear this. And that's meant to describe the high priest in perpetuity, the next one after him as well. But Aaron is the quintessential, let's call it primordial priest. Okay, that sounds like a heavy metal band, primordial priest. Anyway, so Moses is gone. Now the explanation is that later on, when God is going to threaten to destroy the Jewish people, Moses will say, look, if you want to destroy the Jewish people, take my name out of this book that you have written. I don't want any part of it. And that's an incredible defense of the Jewish people, putting his own everything on the line. Of course, Moses, the most humble of all people. But that statement needed some kind of
fulfillment.
And it comes to fulfillment in Parshat Tetzaveh, where the star of the show is Aaron and these vestments of the high priest. And Moses, you said that your name would be erased from the Torah. Okay, a little bit has to happen.
I see another face of it as well, in the sense that in many ways Moshe reaches his ultimate fulfillment in not being present here.
Right.
Because what's he creating? He's creating the robes. He's creating the form which the leaders will wear down through the generations. And he has served his role by not being present, because, of course, just as Moses didn't lead us into the land, and just as God saw fit even to hide his burial place in order that we not turn to him as a person and worship his person, but rather we take the instructions he gave us and we every year anew rebuild. Right? And so in many ways, his absence here is a sign of his great power. I mean, it puts me in mind of that scene in Star Wars that, you know, if you strike me down, I will become stronger than you can even imagine. Here he is in my absence, but you're reading my Torah.
Mm. Love it. That's a great thought. And this week's Torah portion as I said, the star, you said the removal of Moses is his greatness. The star of the show is going to be Aaron, but again, not in any narrative form, in a very technical form. He doesn't star in any kind of, he doesn't do any good, great things. The only thing that he's a star about is that he's going to be doing this work. He's going to be doing this avoda, and this is what he's going to look like. It's almost as though the clothing is the man in this case. And I want to make a parallel between another very famous story, and that is creation. Creation first starts with the vessels of creation: the earth, the sun and the moon, the stars, then the waters and the trees and the grasses, then the animals, then the man. Similarly, we have learned first of the, and when we talk about the tabernacle, which is like the world, first, we've learned about the vessels. It's got the showbread table, got the menorah. We talked about these things last week. And now that the external has been created, the kind of playing field, the court, now we're getting a description of the way that the person inside, the gardener of the Garden of Eden, the Adam, the body of Adam, is going to be inserted into this tabernacle through the learning of the vestments, meaning to say the person inside the machine, the person inside the machine is now being introduced to us. Do you like that parallel?
I do like it, and the language of clothing speaks a lot to me, because in many ways, one of the ways I understand the parallel between creation and the whole construct of the Mishkan, the tabernacle, including the clothes of the high priest, who, remember, is the bridge, in a sense. He's the active element between the people and God that plays there in the temple. I understand it at each creation and the Mishkan as God enclothing himself, so to speak, in a way in which we can know. Right? Because the great desire, as I have been taught and as I understand it, the great desire that leads to creation at all is God's desire to be known. Right? And we're known actually through our specificity. I think there's a.
I just want to pause that, and I want everybody to hear that and highlight and underline what you just said, which is God's great will is to be known, and therefore our job is to help that happen in this world.
It's twofold, and it's beautiful because our job is, of course, to know God and to make God known. But there's a deep teaching in the way that happens because we're created B'Tselem Elohim, we're created in the image of God, which means that also our primary desire is to be known. And they often people think this is an ego trip. I mean, you know, I should be self-effacing. It's not about me. It's about God. God says, no, come on. But I made you. And in essence, you are an expression of my will. So therefore, by making yourself known in a true way, not in a, you know, ego self-serving, but in a true way, making yourself known, bringing out everything that's inside you, you are making me known. The two don't contradict.
So does that come into contradiction with the fact that Moses' name is removed? Or is it because the very fact that we're having this conversation, right? And the very fact that the first question is, well, where is Moses' name? That in itself, we get to know Moses through the fact that he's absent.
Well, I mean, Moses ultimately reaches that point where as the most humble of people, he, let's face it, who's better known than Moses?
Number one man.
Right? And at the same time, he is known for his humility and the fact that his ultimate goal was to make God known to the people and to the world and to teach us this very important fact that the Torah comes to teach us how to be ourselves. And in order that God's will be expressed in the world, we have to sort of embrace it and engage it. So really, Moshe kind of goes through the whole process of becoming known. And then in the end, his last act, so to speak, is to step aside and basically say, okay, now here you go. You take the story and you become known.
Folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show. I guess that's why I called that show after my name, which I never felt comfortable with, but a lot of people told me that's the way to do it. And we are broadcasting on thelandofisrael.com, and we are in Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com, for more great audio content with Rabbi Mike Foyer, and other great rabbis and teachers in this tremendous atmosphere that is in this Beit Midrash, in this Torah learning, and this really life learning institute. And we're in the heart of Jerusalem, which is how God's name is going to be known. And speaking of names, I also want to thank Jack, who dedicates this show to his wife Lillian and his sister Sarah and their families, whom I have met and who I really love. And I think that they are the kind of people that not only want to be connected to Torah, but want others to be connected as well. They're willing to share in order so that all of you will be connected to Torah. If you want to help make that happen, please go to YishaiFleischer.com and dedicate a show and be part of it. Now, speaking of names, there's an expression of carrying burden on your shoulders, or you have to have wide shoulders in order to take a big weight, or I feel heavy, I've got a lot of burden on my shoulders. The shoulders language is one that's kind of common, I think, in most languages, and it really means carrying something important, and oftentimes it's not necessarily just the weight. Anybody who's been in the army knows that, you know, when you carry a what's it called, alunka?
Alunka is a stretcher.
A stretcher. You put it on your shoulder, so you understand that sometimes you have to take something very important, and the vessels, like for example, the Ark of the Covenant was taken on shoulders. But in this week's Torah portion is a different shoulders, and that is Aaron. The high priest is going to be wearing these two Shoham stones, these two special stones, precious stones, and they're going to have the 12 names of Israel on them, six and six, six and six. You know about the Ten Commandments, it's five and five, but here it's six and six, and he's going to carry the weight of the Jewish people's names on his shoulders. So too, we're going to learn that in a complex combination of letters, the names of the Jewish people are going to be also on the breastplate, on the precious stones that are going to be worn on the chest of the high priest of Aaron, and their names are going to be, the Torah says, on his heart as he enters the Holy of Holies, as he walks around within the tabernacle complex. And I thought to myself, I felt slightly uncomfortable. I felt slightly uncomfortable while rereading this today, because I thought to myself, look, this is the highest man of mankind. And the highest man of mankind in the highest place, meeting the highest thing, which is God, kind of face-to-face with the Creator. There's really no other way to describe him. And instead of being totally, you know, have a picture of the globe and have a number of 7 billion on him, you know, and carry the weight of the burden of 7 billion people and all that, you know, and I don't know, all the other creations as well. No, he's got the 12 names of Israel, and he's got to keep them on his heart as he comes into the Holy of Holies. And I thought to myself, back to, I guess, knowing, you know, like we were talking about, like Moses, like, you know, how much is a person supposed to kind of put himself out there? Like, is it really all about us? Is that the weight that Aaron has to carry on his shoulders, which is the name of the Jewish people of Israel, the tribes of Israel? That's it. That's that. It's about our pater, not pater, what's it called? Cosa Nostra. You know what I mean? Our thing, our project. Is that what it is? Or, you know, our family's affair? Or is that somehow symbolic of something bigger?
I think it's an expression of the essence of what he's doing there. You know, if we look forward, because you said here's the holiest man, and he's going to this holiest place, and he's meeting the Holy One. Right? You left out one thing, which is the dimension of time. Because at the holiest time, which is Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, he goes to the inside of the inside. And, you know, later, when we get to Parshat Achrimot, when the Torah actually describes the process of him going there, it will start with a very important message, which is very easy to miss, which is, Bezot Yavo Aaron El HaKodesh. Bezot, with this. And it doesn't say with what. It goes on to a description, and I think in the simple sense you could read meaning with what follows. But don't miss it. Bezot. It's in the specificity that you can come into contact with the divine. And you know, I think this is a tremendous mistake that the nations of the world make, is that they say, no, specificity, that's like a degradation of the ideal. Come on. Like spirituality is transcendent, right? Humanity in its totality is holy. You know, the earth in its whole is good. Okay, individuals, you know, what are you going to do? And the whole message of Am Yisrael is the exact opposite. That actually, specificity, each particular thing participates in the infinite because of its uniqueness. It's in our uniqueness that we participate in the divine, because you're infinite in the sense that there is nothing else like you. And the elevation of life that comes from this, the preciousness, I mean, you think about it, the other ideologies of the world that have claimed spiritual greatness or the abstraction of truth have a tendency to erase the meaningfulness of individuals. How many individuals have been sacrificed for ideas over time? How many of them are dying right now, not so far from us, in service of a false god? You know, the message of Am Yisrael is, listen, of course we're trying to attach ourselves to the divine, to the Holy One, to the totality of creation. But there, you can't have a relation to the abstract. You can't have a relation to the infinite. God doesn't love the abstract, and we can't attach to the infinite. It's in the specificity. And therefore, that is why Aaron brings the names.
That specificity, in the end, leads to, it's like a domino effect. It's like, start with this. This is the kind of the head of nations, and it will trickle down.
Absolutely, because if God can attach to the specific person of Aaron in these right. specific clothes, with that specific color, that means that he can attach to anything. Because otherwise, well, God only attaches to the great things, to the abstract. No. God attaches to every single person who reaches out to touch him.
In a specific place, in a specific time, to a specific person.
Exactly.
With specific memories, and that's what filters down to the world. Yet, here's another interesting vestment in this week's Torah portion. Sure, there's a special time, special place, special man, but even the special man has got to come a-knocking. He can't be just walking in, blithely walking in, hey God, can I talk with you? It's me, Aaron. Even as he walks around within the tabernacle, he's got to make a little ding-a-ding-ding noise, a little kind of, how shall we say, he's got to make his presence known and heard, and in a sense come knocking. That's what I was saying before. You have to kind of, I don't know what the word is, you have to ask to enter. Mm-hmm. And there's a special technical vestment, and that is the coat, I think it's the Me'il, right? And the Me'il, that's called the coat, which will have in it 72 little metallic pieces at the bottom. Alternatively, a rimon, a pomegranate, pomon zahava rimon, a little bell and a golden pomegranate. Little bell, golden pomegranate. Little bell, golden pomegranate. And when he walks around, there's going to be that distinctive jingle jangle of a thousand voices. As he walks around, what do you think about kind of knocking at the door of God and letting him know we're there?
Well, of course, I mean, God knows we're there. And there's two things, I think. One is in the simple meaning of the text, and the other one, I think, is in what I hear you saying, which is that the invitation, the reminder, the knocking is really to ourselves. Because there's nothing more dangerous than entering into a situation of intimacy without actually being present to it. You know, I mean, like, you know, when I'm running around picking up kids and making dinner and doing stuff at home, if I don't give my full attention to my wife, she's not so surprised. She may not be so happy, but she understands, okay, we're all doing lots of stuff. If once the kids are in bed and we sit down to have, I don't know, a glass of wine or eat dinner together or something, if in that moment I haven't brought my full self to it, if I don't hear the invitation that I'm carrying with me, then there's a great danger, right? And that's one. The two is, the Torah says explicitly, is that no one else can be around. This isn't just a warning. It's not just a knocking on the door to God. It's not just a warning to Aaron himself. It's a message to everyone else, which is really, if you want to meet God, it happens in the private spaces. It's an act of intimacy. And that's what Aaron is establishing, that link for the world where everyone can participate. You know, we daven together as Jews. We pray together, right? There's a communal obligation for prayer. A minimum of 10 men come together. And yet, the height of the prayer service is silent. So the real power in being silent together, because we begin by making those little noises, the ringing, reminding each other where we're going. And at the end of the day, everybody steps into their own heart and hopefully is alone with God.
I guess that jingle jangle stops when he stops moving, mm-hmm. you know, when he approaches, and then there's like a stoppage. And in the absence of movement, there's that silence, and that silence is when you're actually speaking. In my work over the years, I have learned a lot about giving something the right title or the right caption. Mm-hmm. A photo can be very powerful, but the right caption can really send it over the top. It really sends the message. Captioning is very important in this world. Just a story to illustrate. Many years ago, there was a protest in Hebron against the Jewish presence there, and the Lord put into my head an idea of a poster. And the poster that I made said three words, Abba Kavur Po. Dad is buried here. And another poster, Ima Kvura Po, Mom is buried here. And I was countering the anti-Jewish community poster protest with our own counter and pro-Jewish community protest. And I just had these signs. I didn't say anything else. Not you're bad, not we're going to stand forever. Dad is buried here. And I knew I had a winner. I knew it. And of course, it was in the next day's Haaretz. I just knew that it was just too strong. That simple message. So writing that right writing the caption on the poster is very important. Why am I bringing this up, you may wonder? And the answer is because there is a captioning that happens in this week's Torah portion on the high priest himself. He wears a head plate, a forehead plate, a golden forehead plate. And it says on the forehead plate, if you were wondering, who is this dude that's dressed up like this? And what is he ministering to? What is he doing? It says, in simple, plain words, Kodesh LaHashem, holy or sanctified unto God. That is the message. That is the caption. If you see him, he's like wearing a pin. Hi, I'm sanctified unto God. Or my work is sanctified unto God. That's what I'm doing here. And it's just captioned. It's captioned on its own. It's right there. If you're wondering what this whole thing is about, that's what it's about.
And it's very important, of course, since Aaron is the Kohen Gadol, he's the great priest, and he carries that caption, that means that Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, carry the same caption, because we are Mamlechet Kohanim. We're a kingdom of priests. And therefore, I really feel, you know, we talk a lot in the show, out of the show. I know in your life you're very involved in messaging to the world, in really trying to get, and not in a manipulative propaganda sense, but in a really transformative educational sense. And this is a message that we need to communicate first and foremost to ourselves, but really to the world, is that, you know, that we're Kodesh Hashem. The problem is what does that mean? I really believe that the nations of the world have corrupted this world, Kodesh. because Kodesh, you're a priest, you're elitist, you're separatist, you're special, you're privileged. No. The word means devoted. It means devoted, and therefore the role of Aaron is to connect the whole world to God, and that's why we have to be a holy people. We can't live in monasteries or on hilltops alone, separate from the world. We got to build buildings. We got to plant farms. We got to, you know, pave roads. We got to have politics and with all the difficulties and that goes with that. But we have to attach it and devote it all to God.
That's a great teaching. Devotion. That word devotion, be devoted and devoted to God. I like that very much. And that's what that caption is. So if you want to take that caption onto yourself, this is the I want to shift a gear for a second here and talk about this Torah portion on the whole. And that is, I find that one of the greatest lessons of this Torah portion, which is a blueprint for a real thing that was and which will be, the tabernacle and later the temple and the vestments, these are being recreated as discussed in this week's Torah portion and shall be used in the third temple, no question about it. But they can be used even right now. And what I mean is that I find these discussions and these images to be great images of meditation. Mm-hmm. Great images of meditation. Just, I don't know, for me, the image of this man standing with this golden forehead plate that says Kodesh L'Hashem. If I just put that in my mind, the beauty of it and the interestingness of it all, the fascination of it all, it's really a way to put it in your mind and to cause kind of prayer to come down. For me, I personally use the cherubs on top of the Ark of the Covenant and just concentrating on that spot in between them. Or in this week's Torah portion also, again, what we talked about earlier, the Pamon Verimon, just thinking about the little bell with the pomegranate of gold. For some, and by the way, that pomegranate of gold has been found. We have found one of those little pomegranates of gold from the hem of the Kohen Gadol. So it's a real thing. My point is that these images are there to they serve something in the mind. If you can concentrate them, and you're of course very into the issue of prayer, and that's linked into meditation. Tell me a little bit about visualizing these things in the process of devotion.
I mean, you've put your finger on what I believe to be one of the primary reasons the Torah devotes such exhaustive space to the specificity of what's being built here, right? Because not only because the act itself in its own time was sacred, and not only because, as you pointed out, speedily in our day, these things will be remade, but because, you know, we fail to appreciate the power of imagination and imagery because we live in a world so saturated by images. I mean, who knows how many pictures of clothing and people, et cetera, that I saw before I was even aware of what I was looking at, you know? Whereas what the Torah is doing here is it's inviting us to generate a holiness of imagination, right? And the one of the primary utilities is what you pointed out, is that in prayer, that we should have these images and allow them to shape our conceptions, right? Those inner images of the imagination that we you know what imagination is? Imagination is the ability to touch something which you've never actually seen, right? And therefore, our master and teacher Rav Kook tells us that imagination is one of the core powers connected to prophecy, to nevuah. Because, of course, I've never seen God. I can't imagine. I wouldn't want to worship a God who I could conceive of, right? Because I don't want to limit God to my conception. So it takes a leap of holy imagination to actually reach out to God, be it in prayer or in its ultimate crowning in prophecy. And therefore, these parshiot, I believe, in their specificity, again, in the specificity, awaken within us the ability to imagine what is holy and therefore to stay connected to something which is not bounded by our limited conception.
I think you said something there that also our non-Jewish listeners should hear and kind of underline, which is the connection to God, who I don't conceptualize, who's not like me, it's a very high level. And those who understand. Finally, there's a non sequitur seemingly in this week's Torah portion in that we go back at the end of the Torah portion to vessels. Or more specifically, vessel. And that is the vessel of the incense altar. This does not fit in this week's Torah portion. It should have been in last week's Torah portion, Truma. We talked about the other Mizbech, what's that called?
Altar.
The other altar, right? We talked about the other altar, the animal sacrifice altar, last week's Torah portion. Why is it that suddenly the incense altar, which is made of gold and it sits closer, it's much closer to the Holy of Holies, and you bring coals, burning coals from the meat altar, the animal sacrifice altar, to inside to the holy area and the holier area, and there you put down these coals, and on top of that you put this ketorah, the special incense, and it makes this kind of incredible smoke, an incredible scent. Why is the story of the scent altar, the incense altar, in this week's Torah portion and not in the last one?
My understanding of it is because it's the culmination of everything that we've built over the last 2 weeks. I mean, we could have a halachic discussion, a legal discussion, about what's the most important aspect of the temple service, etc. But I think that experientially, that the offering of incense is the ultimate act of service. Why? Because what are you doing? You're taking these 11 various elements of the world, spices and herbs and various things. You're reducing them to a powder with your own power, and then you're offering them up to God to release what's inside them, right? And that's what the temple is meant to do. It's meant to bring together all of your experience. Everything you think about, the Jewish people have now been on every corner of the world. We've encountered every language, every culture, everything you could imagine. But the goal is to bring it all back together and offer it up to God. And that image of reich nichoach, right, a pleasing aroma to God, you know, is because when we look back to the story of Eden and to Adam's failure there in the story of Eden, right, he sees the tree, he tastes the fruit, he touches it, he listens to the serpent. But you know what he doesn't do? Doesn't smell anything wrong. Right? There's an intimacy of contact with the world and with the divine that actually happens through aroma, which was untainted by that original failure, and therefore this is its fixing. So in the same way, like you said, that the tabernacle is a reconstruction of the world, and the vestments are the sort of getting ready for the game, the uniform in which you're going to play. So the offering of the incense then becomes the fixing, bringing the world back together.
And Mashiach is going to have an incredible sense of smell. He's going to be able to tell, he's going to smell you out, and he's going to say, you're from this tribe. You're actually related to this tribe. He's going to be able to do that. He's going to be able to tell where you're actually from. He's going to smell your DNA, and he's also going to smell justice and injustice. And interestingly enough, and I'll finish off with this, in Israel recently, a company has developed the ability to smell you, and every person has got like a fingerprint. He's got a unique smell. But those smells are sometimes tainted with sicknesses and diseases. And through smells, they will be able to identify if you're a potential cancer carrier or other things. They'll be able to smell you out. They'll just smell you out and say, you need this, this, and this, and this, because you need this medicine to preempt, because you're already starting to smell a little bad, okay? And we want to smell really great. We want to smell great to God. We want to make this world smell better. Right now, there's a lot of stink. I heard a figure today that puts the deaths in Syria at a half a million, at 500,000 over the last 5 years, and not the 200,000-250,000 number that was floated around. Now the semi-official number is about 500,000 people killed, and the war continues to rage. The world is a stinky place, but Israel is here in order to make it smell better and to bring a reich nichoach lifnei Hashem, to bring a pleasing smell, pleasing aroma. And of course, by the study of this Torah, you are bringing an amazing scent into this world. I do want to plug also Hebron, which is the second holiest city in Judaism, but also the place of great smells. Why do I say that? Because it was Abraham who smelled the smell of Garden of Eden at the Maarat HaMachpelah, tells us the Zohar, at the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs. He smelled that amazing scent, which is really where the world is going to come back to be a Garden of Eden. Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you so much for joining me here on Spiritual Cafe.
Always a pleasure. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected. Write me an email, yeshai@thelandofisrael.com, and be part of the story. God bless you, and Shalom.